Welcome everybody to Disclosed TV and our relatively new chat room. We're fortunate enough to have developed this function to include guests from the international stage. And tonight we have with us James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com, FukushimaUpdate.com, Global Research TV, and BoilingFrogsPost.com, who was with us here for the first time back in July. And with current events as they are, James was gracious enough to return to answer, some of our questions, especially regarding what's going on in Syria and the disaster in Fukushima. So, James, welcome back to Disclosed TV.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, we got our first question is from Spock, and he writes. He wanted to ask you if you heard anything regarding the supposed nuclear warheads, which were reportedly moved, unsigned for, from Dallas Air Force Base in Texas to be picked up somewhere in South Carolina. He says, I can tell you that the Greenville-Spartanburg International Airport, there have been many touch-and-go landings, takeoffs of C-17 cargo planes, which is not unusual. However, a report from the local news talk station said a few weeks ago that that 19 C-17 cargo planes had moved through that airport and that they closed the airport to traffic during that exercise. A caller also said at the time the air traffic was sanitized like when a nuke is at play. Living in the upstate, I have been nervous about this for weeks, only to have Senator Graham tell an audience that essentially we did not have a bomb. If we did not bomb Syria, America could witness a nuclear detonation from the belly of a cargo ship in Charleston Harbor. I know this is a lot of hearsay, but the timing of it is peculiar. So we wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't have any information on that other than what's been presented there. I have heard about the story, but I don't really have any sort of inside scoop on what's going on there.
I'll get to go to the second question then, which is actually three. What do you think the estimated cost of the cleanup in Fukushima is? After all, we don't have the technology to even go in and see what's happening, let alone the technology to clean it up. To add to the cost, we need that technology by yesterday, and we still need somewhere to store it all. Second, where are the long-term spent fuel rods pools in the flood line? Let's see, where are the long-term spent fuel rods below flood line, and if so, what effect do you think the salt water might have had on them? After all, nobody in their right mind would ever store fuel rods in salt water due to its corrosive and conductive properties. And third, how large is the tank farm going to become, and how long are they going to keep it there? After all, it's known to the area is prone to earthquakes and tsunamis. So I got through that.
You did, but I'm not that bright, so I might need a reminder of those questions as I answer them. But as to the first one, estimated cost of the cleanup is $500 billion, and I don't know exactly what orifice they're pulling that number out of. But I think, as the question indicated, the technology for the cleanup, in fact, doesn't yet exist. Even the robotics that would be required to get anywhere near the cores at this point, in order to at least start the cleanup, doesn't actually exist yet. So I don't know how they're estimating the cost for the development of that technology. But at any rate, it's going to be a staggering sum of money, even for the third largest economy on the planet. And I'm not sure it's going to be they're estimating 40 years until things are relatively under control there. But again, I don't know how they're estimating that, because it depends on so many variables that are not foreseen. As to the second part, asking about the whether the spent fuel rods were being stored below the sea level, below the flood line. The spent fuel rods were contained in reactor 4 building above the reactor, so they are still currently being kept at an elevated position. The problem with that is that the building is not only unstable, but now they are actually attempting to get those fuel rods out of there. And Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.org has described it as trying to take cigarettes out of a crumpled cigarette pack. It's not the same as taking them out of a straight cigarette pack. And in this case, that's not even a good analogy because it's the type of operation that even in the best of circumstances, I mean, they use robotics and computer equipment to get the fuel rods out usually because it is a very delicate operation. And if the rods come even into too close contact, etc., it can actually start a chain reaction. So reactor 4 spent fuel rod situation is a huge problem, and they're going to start in the next month or two actually taking the fuel out of there. And as Arne Gunderson and others have noted, that is an extremely delicate operation, and if something goes wrong there, then you might as well evacuate the Northern Hemisphere. So I think that's something we should all be keeping our eyes on. And to the issue of seawater in the reactors generally, it was in fact the plant manager at the Fukushima plant who, in the hours after the initial flood, decided to actually pump seawater into there in order to basically stop the reactors from just going critical right then and there. And if he hadn't have done that, it would have been much, much worse. He, in fact, did that against TEPCO's company orders because they didn't want to damage the reactors in a way that would make them unusable in the future. And he actually did that against company orders and ended up saving untold numbers of lives in doing that. So it, the reactors themselves are, of course, completely useless now. They've been corroded by salt, seawater and the like, but at least... Well, Japan isn't uninhabitable yet. And then thirdly, you're going to have to remind me what the third part of that question was.
That was about the containment tank. I think it says how large is the tank farm going to become and how long are they going to keep it there? It's not like they can just keep building concrete around it or anything. What are they going to do with what's left?
Right. Yes. Okay. So I'm assuming this is talking about the tanks that have that they're using to store the water that they've been pumping through there, and that is radioactive and contaminated. And I can't remember who it was. It was someone either. I think it was someone with TEPCO recently. No, I believe actually it was the chairman of the new Japanese Nuclear Regulatory Authority. Shunichi Tanaka, I believe, who came out recently and said that they are going to have to at some point dump the stored water at sea because they are running out of space. And I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it was some ridiculous figure about the amount of contaminated water that's coming that they're having to store on a daily basis. I mean, they're using so much water there. So he said they will have to dump some of it out to sea at some point because they can't store it all, but only after they've decontaminated it to an acceptable level by international standards, whatever that means. So I'm sure we can trust them as far as we can throw them, which wouldn't be very far at all. And just as another example of that, they during the recent typhoon that passed through directly across Fukushima, they ended up releasing a bunch of radioactive water at that time, and there's no indication that they did any test on radioactivity levels before and after they did that. They just did it and said, don't worry, it wasn't very radioactive water. So that's pretty much the situation there. As for groundwater contamination, they have come up with this wonderful plan that I'm sure will work in every possible facet to actually freeze the soil around the reactor. So they're actually going to create a, quote, ice wall to try to keep the radioactive water from basically contaminating the groundwater and leaking across into the under the mainland of Japan. So that is a wonderful idea, and I can't think of anything that will go wrong except for the fact that it's never been tried before in human history, and even they admit that's only a short-term measure because they can't keep it... They can't keep doing that indefinitely. So again, things are deteriorating on that front, and we've seen that even recently with a lot of leaks coming out of those tanks that they're using to store the water. So the radioactive water that's going through that plant on a daily basis is one of the main concerns at the moment.
Like all that'll work. Shaggy wants to know if, you know, seeing that you're based and live in Japan, knowing all that's coming from Fukushima, do you have concerns of the radiation for yourself? And do you do any preventive measures like silver nitrate or any other means of protection?
Well, of course, it is a concern, and that's exactly why I do keep a close eye on what's going on at the plant and what's happening in Japan generally. And we can separate the idea of the radiation coming from Fukushima into a couple of different categories. And one would be general atmospheric contamination, which was what was happening during the first few months of the disaster when it was just belching radioactive steam up into the atmosphere. And then there's the radioactive water situation, which is what we were talking about there. At this point, the general atmospheric belching steam out into the atmosphere is not happening. The reactors are submerged in water at this point, and it's not boiling away at this point. So there is no further atmospheric contamination coming out in that manner. But the real problem is the radioactivity of the water that is, as we say, being dumped out into the sea basically directly at this point. And so with that in mind, myself, my wife, my family, we do not purchase basically any seafood that's coming from the Pacific Ocean at this point. And it's becoming increasingly more difficult to do that, but I guess we'll just stop eating seafood entirely as it becomes more difficult to source seafood that's not from that area. They had a ban on fishing in Fukushima Bay last year, up until last year. They lifted it. They reinstituted it just earlier this month, because of the recent problems with those radioactive leaks in the water leaking out into Fukushima Bay. So, again, I don't really trust what's going on there, and I don't even trust the labeling on the fish. I mean, all products here basically tell you where they're from, even within Japan. It'll have a prefecture or what have you, but I'm not sure I really trust their labeling or trust the fishermen and everyone involved in that process to be on the level when it comes to talking about where these products are coming from. On the note of just general radiation concerns, I would point people to safecast.org, which is they have a network of people just with their own Geiger counters and the like that feed all of that information, the data from literally thousands and thousands and thousands of users. They feed into a map that creates a live, basically a live map of radiation and what readings are in various parts of Japan and, in fact, all over the world where people are feeding data into this. It's a fascinating map. I hope people will go check it out. Again, I think that's safecast.org. And when you go and check it out, you'll see that, for example, of course, the radiation around Fukushima, of course, is extremely high, and it dissipates as you get further and further away from Fukushima, as you would expect, to the point where here I am about 400 miles southwest of Fukushima, and the radiation readings of the Safecast members here is about the same as, in fact, considerably less than in certain areas of the United States, Nevada and other obvious places like that, where there is just higher radiation levels. So I would really suggest people check that out to take a look at just what general atmospheric radiation exists, and people might be surprised about the radiation in their own area.
Well, James, what are the people on the street, the local people, I mean, are they oblivious to it, or are they aware of it? I mean, it's like, you know, in the United States, people watch television and they get all their information from there. What are the people in Japan? Are they a bunch of sheep too?
Well, I don't like to characterize anyone as sheep because, to me, that's like blaming the victim for their victimization. So I don't like to do that. But certainly, Japan is known as a very compliant society, and they have been under the feudal conditioning that really just transformed into the current order, which is kind of like a feudal capitalism that they have here. It's kind of bizarre, but basically the old samurai families and the prestigious shoguns and what have you just basically turned into the big corporations of today. So it's a very similar system to what used to exist. It's just it's kind of a capitalist framework, but it's the same idea. So it's a very bizarre situation over here generally, and people do tend to be compliant, and they have, you know, the nail that sticks up will be hammered down and those kinds of sayings. So I think that's reflective of the general tendency of Japanese society. But having said that, I think that there has been a lot of genuine concern among the Japanese people here about this. I mean, obviously nuclear power, for obvious reasons, I would say, is not, it has never been widely popular here. I mean, it's something that's been tolerated for decades because of an immense propaganda campaign that, interestingly enough, began back in the 1950s, or was it the 1960s, with actual CIA Mockingbird assets, people we know were on the payroll of the CIA, who were writing editorials in some of the Japanese newspapers here talking about how great nuclear power is. So this goes back decades and decades. But there is and has been a strong anti-nuclear sentiment here since this became the first country to be and the only country to be bombed with nuclear weapons in wartime. So this is a very touchy subject for the population, and we have seen that reflected from time to time. For example, last year during the summer months, we saw some massive protests that were taking place in Tokyo on a weekly basis, and they were even going to the Prime Minister's residence and going to protest at the Japanese Parliament building, etc. And that was drawing out tens of thousands, in fact, hundreds of thousands, if you believe the organizers, and a few thousand if you believe the police. But still, tens of thousands of people did show up for those protests, and it did have a pretty big effect. And the Prime Minister ultimately had to start to meet with the protesters and at least give lip service to the idea that he was going to do something about it. That kind of petered out in the winter months, and I don't think we've seen a resurgence of that type of activity this year. But still, people are angry about what's happened. You can find some of this online, of YouTube videos of people taping some of the meetings that TEPCO and government officials have been giving, and people grilling these government officials about what's going on and really talking back to them, etc., which is not the type of thing you see in everyday discourse here in Japan. So I think that is different. There are signs that there are cracks in the system here, because, I mean, for example, there was a TV news presenter here who recently on her own, I think it was her own personal blog or Twitter or something of that nature, actually made comments about the situation at Fukushima, and she's worried about the radiation. And that was, I mean, that's still seen as a big no-no. You can't have a TV presenter actually giving her own opinion about something. But it does go to show, I think, how far the traditional walls of polite Japanese society have broken down on this issue. And I think that the Japanese people are generally quite concerned, but it's not the kind of thing that you would hear them just randomly discussing on the street. I mean, it's still the type of thing that people are concerned about, but there's not a lot of discussion about it that goes on in polite, you know, mixed society.
Well, I don't even know what to say. We have a member who asks, why does the world stand by and let TEPCO continue to get away with this, to run this cleanup? And why is there such a blackout in the U.S. Of the conditions?
Well, why does the world allow this to continue? I guess that question presupposes that there is an object called the world, but of course there isn't. There's 7 billion people who happen to be subdivided into arbitrary geographical regions divided by imaginary lines on maps that are ruled over by people who appoint themselves or are appointed in some mystical process to be rulers over the rest of society. And these are the people who make the decisions that affect, well, the rest of us, the billions of us. So it's a pretty... I understand the idea behind the question, but I'm also extremely concerned about the way that would play out. Because if, for example, we say, well, we just have to get the United Nations in there or something of that nature, then I think what this ultimately ends up being is the type of disaster that's used as just another paving stone on the way towards world government. So it is a question of how that would be organized and who it would be organized by and under what auspices and what framework that's going to create, what institutions and structures that's going to reinforce, and basically who gets to arbitrate that process. And that's there's a lot of very sticky issues going on there, which is exactly why I think that the idea of outside influence or interference in this process has not really been floated seriously by anyone at this point. I mean, TEPCO has asked for international assistance, and I think that's definitely the way to go. We do need experts and people who know what they're doing flying in there and actually doing something about the site. But what I think we do not need is, for example, the IAEA to come in there and proclaim, now this is United Nations territory and we will administer what's happening at the plant. Because ultimately, people have to understand that it's always, always, always the case that the regulators who claim and presume to have authority over these various matters always are the ones who are the most corrupt and corrupted and corruptible. And the IAEA is absolutely no difference. In fact, people can look up the secret treaty, the secret agreement that the IAEA signed with the WHO, the World Health Organization, back in the 1950s, where basically they agreed that they will never touch on either of the other agency's mandates. They will never do any work unless it's approved of by that agency. So what this means in practice is that the WHO does not pronounce on nuclear matters related to nuclear health and nuclear accidents, nuclear radiation, without the IAEA's stamp of approval. And the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is just an adjunct of the nuclear energy industry. It's there to support the nuclear energy industry and to make sure that it continues to function. That's its real mandate. So the IAEA is never going to step in and be the type of independent arbitrator that people, I think, would like to see in this situation. And putting more power in their hands is extremely scary.
I find it all disconcerting when you think about the effects that it has on the rest of the world, and we're clueless and unable to do anything. I mean, jumping up and down and screaming doesn't seem to be doing any good because nobody's hearing me. But I can't imagine, you know, what's going through some of the people, the well-educated people's minds in that country. You know, there's nothing that can be done. You know, I guess it's kind of like here. You have politicians who nod their head and look the other way. That's something like that going on there.
Unfortunately, very much so. And in fact, we just recently saw a former prime minister of Japan come out and accuse the current prime minister of flat out lying to the International Olympic Committee, because as people probably know, Tokyo was just awarded the 2020 Olympics. And in order to do that, of course, the current prime minister here, Shinzo Abe, had to say, well, of course, the Fukushima situation is completely under control and there's no problem there anymore, which even TEPCO, everyone kind of cleared their throat and looked the other way at that statement, because it's so ridiculous on its face. And we know that, I mean, just the leaks of the last couple of weeks have proven that that's definitely not the case. So so absolutely, unfortunately, the politicians continue to lie about this for their own various reasons. I mean, there's a lot of them are just bought off. I mean, corruption in the Japanese political system is absolutely pervasive, and a lot of them are beholden to, of course, the very nuclear energy interests that have the interest in making sure that nuclear power continues, and that's done quite overtly here through through donations and things of that nature that are given by nuclear energy industry corporations to municipalities and prefectural governments here as kind of buy-offs, tokens, bribes for allowing new reactors to be built in various parts of the country. And that's the way it's functioned for decades, and I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. And the new nuclear regulatory authority that was set up in the wake of this Fukushima disaster, it was discovered within weeks of it having been set up that basically everyone on the board had received bribes from nuclear energy companies at some point in their careers. So again, business as usual, and I don't think we can expect the Japanese politicians to be the saviors in this case.
It's just a pretty sad state of affairs when the people in charge are covering up for the ones who are at fault or something to that effect. Well, I mean, as interesting as that is, I kind of have to move on because there's other questions. But who do you think the chemical weapons, or where do you think the chemical weapons used in Syria came from? Do you have any intuition about that?
Well, I don't know about intuition, but there have been reports for a while now that they sourced from Saudi Arabia, and specifically from Prince Bandar, better known as Bandar Bush, the former Saudi ambassador to Washington, who's currently the Saudi intelligence chief. And these are reports that are coming from, amongst other places, also a report that was filed by Yahya Ababne and Dale Gavlak for Mint Press News a few weeks ago now, where Yahya Ababne actually was there in the Ghouta area interviewing some of the rebels, we should use the word that applies here, the terrorists, about what actually took place there, and getting them on the record about the handling of weapons that were supplied by the Saudis. They weren't told what they were. They were just told that they should be use extra care when handling them. Some of the weapons actually went off when the terrorists were handling them, killing a few of them. And then the other ones were used, and it became what it became. It became the chemical weapons attack. This is the story that's been provided to some of the reporters on the ground, and it has been, of course, completely suppressed in the Western media. And in fact, Dale Gavlak is a correspondent for AP and has worked with the BBC and other prestigious news gathering institutions in the past. So there was a lot of credibility, mainstream credibility to this report. But interestingly enough, Dale, she was immediately threatened by basically pressure from the Saudis to say that they will scrap her career if she doesn't back away from the story. And lo and behold, the AP has now suspended her without any comment as to why. So there you go. There goes a journalistic career down the tubes because she dared speak out against authority. But again, this all sources back seemingly to Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia. And that makes a lot of sense for different reasons. I mean, certainly Saudi Arabia has been one of the key backers of these terrorist insurgent groups into Syria for obvious reasons. Of course, Saudi being the base of Wahhabi Sunni terrorists and being where a lot of this terrorism stems from, and having been historically the people who have long been funding and backing all sorts of terrorists in the region. And of course, the Saudi royal family also has an interest in making sure that the Shiite rebellion, or the Shias generally, don't thrive, don't do very well in the region, because they have their own Shia problem in their eastern provinces where a lot of the oil is, and they want to make sure that the Shias are basically kept in line in their own place. So they have a lot of interest in this, and so it seems that these chemical weapons that were used were supplied by Saudi Arabia. It seems that the terrorists who were handling them didn't even know what they were doing, didn't know what they were using, but it seems that it was the outside insurgents, the outside terrorists who had been shipped into the country who were the ones that ultimately went ahead with it. And that makes sense from a lot of different perspectives, and of course it makes sense under the overall context of this being a false flag operation that was designed specifically to try to get the United States and others to come into the country with military intervention, exactly as Obama said they would last year with his infamous red line speech.
That was an incredible video you put out there. Who's really at fault in Syria? I forget the name exactly, but yeah, that whole group of that whole gang, they all seem like they're apart from one another, but yet you got to know that they're all in on it together. I just feel like it's some big game, and they're all having drinks together, talking about, you know, what they're going to do next to, you know, make a profit. I find it disgusting. I guess without any more questions about Syria to go on, do you think that there's any solution?
Solution to what's happening in Syria? Well, I think that the long-term solution, obviously, is for all of the foreign jihadists and foreign money and foreign aid and foreign training and equipment to stop flowing into the country. That would be one good start. And of course, if that were to happen, the so-called insurgency, the terrorist operation that's underway in Syria, would collapse overnight. In fact, they have been losing the ground war against the Syrian government forces for months now. And that's another reason why the idea that suddenly Assad went insane and decided to start using chemical weapons in this fight makes even less sense. I mean, not only is it a suicidal move, not only does it make no sense from the perspective of having waiting until the chemical inspectors were actually in the country in order to use chemical weapons. I mean, that's ridiculous in and of itself. But also, I mean, the fact that that Assad has apparently just gone insane and started using chemical weapons when he's actually winning the ground offensive anyway is just stretching the bounds of credulity a little too far. So I think that the ultimate answer is to get the foreign intervention out of this, and I think the rest would resolve itself fairly quickly. But of course, that's not likely to happen anytime soon, and now we're seeing this wheeling and dealing about the disarming of chemical weapons. Well, if that happens, that's overall, in the bigger picture, a good thing. But of course, why is this standard not being applied to Israel or to any of the other countries in the region? Why is it Syria specifically? And I think the answers to that should be obvious. And unfortunately, it's just another sign of the overall hypocrisy that pervades everything that happens in the region.
I can't agree. I can't agree more. There's some things going on in Kenya. Shaggy writes, now that there are some are saying the American ties to the Kenya West Side Mall, knowing that there are Somalians in the United States, Minnesota, Oregon, and elsewhere, just a thought on the influence of the Al-Shabaab, which seems some concern. This is being put out in the media right now, which show one to expect more privacy be taken away. Any thoughts on Al-Shabaab and concerns for the U.S.?
To be honest, I haven't been following the Kenya story in a lot of detail, so I don't have a lot to say about Al-Shabaab, but I did notice that one of the people who have been fingered as one of the foreign Westerners who have been involved in this incident is a woman who was the wife of one of the alleged 7/7 bombers in London. And that's an interesting story in and of itself. And this is, in fact, someone, I can't remember her name, I think it's Susan something or other, Braithwaite or something along those lines. And we talked about her specifically in an interview that I did with Tom Secker of investigatingtheterror.com back a few months ago. And we talked about the idea that this woman is almost certainly, I can't remember the relations, but it was something like her father or one of her uncles or something like that was in British Special Forces and a member of the British intelligence community and what have you. And lo and behold, she ends up becoming the wife of a 7/7 bomber. And now she's on the run in Africa, causing all these terrorist incidents. It's it's pretty far-fetched if you actually start to look into it. And the consensus that Tom and I reached is that it's the extent that she exists at all, assuming this isn't just a profile that's been made up to sort of put an intelligence kind of figure into it, it is probably a series of basically, it's an identity that intelligence officials in the field in Africa can take on and be basically operating in her name. And now apparently she's, in fact, there were unconfirmed reports that she was one of the dead in this whole operation in Kenya. So just another fascinating tidbit of that. And in fact, Tom Secker has a brand new podcast at spyculture.com, I think it's spyculture.com, where he has a new podcast called Clandestine, and the latest episode is specifically about what's happening in Kenya, so I'm sure he does get into this in more detail. I haven't had the chance to check it out yet myself. I think it just came out in the past 24 hours, but I'm very much looking forward to that, and I'm sure he'll have a lot more to say about Al-Shabaab.
It'll be definitely be interesting to see where that goes. I'd like to pose a couple of questions about some of our favorite subjects here on the conspiracy site. We got somebody wants to know about directed energy weapons and their use on the towers, something like the Hutchinson effect that were used on September 11th. And Dr. Judy Wood, the Dark Heart, wants to know what you think of her work. So I guess, you know, I'm just kind of throwing that out there, see what you know.
Well, I guess the short answer would be that I don't know what brought down the towers. I do know that it was not ordinary fires and jet fuel that brought down the towers and basically pulverized them in midair. That is obviously not what happened. As to what technology did bring it down, well, I'm no expert, and anything I say on that regard would be speculation and probably unproductive, so I will stay away from it, as I always have. The point to me, the larger answer to that question is that it has somewhat disturbed me in the last several years how the idea of 9/11 truth has been, I think, reduced to what brought down the towers. Whereas, in my mind, the operation, the 9/11 operation, was so much more vast, so much more complex, and touched on so many different subjects that it seems have been almost completely abandoned by the 9/11 truth community. And I think that's very much to our detriment. So in my work, I try to concentrate on the financial aspects of what was going on that day, which are fascinating in and of themselves. Not only the billions of dollars in transactions that were being conducted by the computer systems in the World Trade Center, which, according to a Deutsche Bank insider, said it was as if an outside force had taken over the computers just minutes before the attacks and started doing transactions, putting basically taking money out of the system and putting it in places that they didn't even know where it was going. That's a pretty fascinating idea right there, right in and of itself. And of course, that relates to an investigation that was done by a German company called Convar, which received 400 of the hard drives that had been recovered from the Ground Zero. They did research into 39 of them, trying to recover the information. And just from those 39, they had identified hundreds of millions of dollars of anomalous transactions that they couldn't account for, the records of which were stored in those hard drives. And that was in late 2001, I think December of 2001, that report came out. And then we never heard about it again. Convar was swept under the rug. We never heard what happened to the rest of the hard drives. We never heard what happened to the rest of that investigation. And the SEC later came out and said, oh, you know that insider trading that that everyone's talking about? Well, we investigated, and it turns out that it actually, it's sourced to people who had no conceivable connection to Al-Qaeda, and thus we don't have to investigate any further, because of course, I mean, it was Al-Qaeda that did 9/11, so these guys have no connection to Al-Qaeda, so the insider trading couldn't have been related to the 9/11 attack, which is, I mean, on its face, a ridiculous question-begging argument, but that's exactly what the SEC said. And then, just a few years ago, under a Freedom of Information Act request, there were people trying to get information about the SEC investigation into the insider trading and, you know, where it led and how they got to the conclusion that they did. And the SEC replied that, in fact, all of the responses, the records that are responsive to that FOIA request, have been destroyed as part of routine record keeping. So yes, the actual records of the SEC investigation have been destroyed. So that's just another one of the interesting aspects of the financial brouhaha, the mess that occurred on 9/11, as is the records into Enron and other major investigations that were being stored in WTC-7 that went down with that building, as is the $2.3 trillion that eventually escalated to $3.5 trillion that the Pentagon couldn't account for. They just couldn't keep track of this money that they announced in the months leading up to 9/11, and of course, infamously, on September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld declared a new war, a war on bureaucracy, because they had lost so much money at the Pentagon. And lo and behold, the next day, well, no one was talking about the Pentagon's missing trillions. And of course, what was one of the offices that was hit in the newly reinforced section of the Pentagon, where Hani Hanjour, we are expected to believe, piloted a 757 through an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground and hit the building in the newly reinforced area? What was one of the offices that was hit where Several dozen workers died. It was the Pentagon, one of the Pentagon accounting offices, that was working on the problem of the missing trillions. So that's a pretty interesting research alley right there. I could go on and on and on just talking about the financial aspects alone, let alone, of course, the neocons and the plan for the new reshaped Middle East and all of this that was part of the 9/11 operation. It goes on and on and on in this regard. And when I hear people just constantly equate 9/11 truth with just how did the towers fall, it's very disheartening to me, because it seems that people are shying away from some of these perhaps less sexy topics, less exciting in that regard, but I think absolutely vital for an understanding of what really happened that day. And this is something that I attempted to touch on in my 9/11 anniversary coverage this year, where I, for example, spoke to Kevin Ryan, who has another a book out that is just absolutely must-read material. It's called Another 19, in which he talks about another 19 suspects that we could identify as legitimate 9/11 suspects to put in the place of the alleged hijackers that we're expected to believe pulled off this operation. And in this book, he goes into a great degree of detail about these actual 9/11 suspects and their companies and corporations and how they link up to 9/11 that could be used for an actual criminal procedure, a criminal trial, a criminal investigation into 9/11. And I think that is the alley that I think would be most fruitful for us to be exploring at this point and trying to put some of these pieces together. Because, I think if we keep going back to Larry Silverstein pulled WTC7, however true that might be, I think it only takes a look at a tiny sliver of a fraction of what was happening on that day. And I really hope that we can expand the 9/11 discussion beyond that.
Yeah, I totally agree. The fact that the towers came down doesn't it pales in significance to what took place that day when you really get down to it. And I got to admit that the things that you've presented in some of your videos are tremendous. I recommend that everybody here look at them. I don't know if they're still up in the thread. Some of them went away, but I'm pretty sure I posted the revival 9/11 this year. And that's interesting that, you know, here we are on a website where we talk about all these, extreme topics and, you know, trying to dissect things when the big picture is really, really where it's at. And I thank you for what you're doing there. I've got another question here about the rights, users' rights on the World Wide Web. They're being slowly eroded the world over. And recently, with a Tor, once thought safe zone for communications, being shown to be full of security exploits by MIT. Where do you feel the next attack on freedom of communications will come from, and how do you think it'll unfold?
This is a very important question, and not to toot my own horn, but I have been on the record for a few years now saying that Tor is not to be trusted, and that compromised exit nodes can and have been used to track people's information for a while. So absolutely, and of course, where did Tor originate from? It originated from the Office of Naval Intelligence. So, I mean, just like the internet itself, I mean, I think it was designed as all of these systems that were given are, as specifically as tracking tools. And what better way to track people than to create a system that you could tell them, hey, this is, the government can't look at this. Where's it coming from? Oh, the government. I mean, so I think people have to retain a bit of incredulity when it comes to these types of things, and realize that the idea of online anonymity is a pipe dream. And this is something that, for example, it was a point that John Young of Cryptome.org made when I had him on the program a few years ago, and it's really stuck with me and has been proven true in spades over the last few months. And I think that there are a couple of different ways we can take that. I mean, one of them is for us to retreat into our shells and say, well, nothing we do online is safe and they can see everything, so we better stop talking about these issues because we might get the knock on the door one of these days. And I suppose, well, I can't fault anyone for doing that. If they're genuinely afraid of the consequences of free speech, then I guess they can't be participating in that free speech. But to my mind, that's exactly what the surveillance grid is designed to do. It is designed to get people retreating into their shell and afraid to talk about these issues and afraid to do anything because, oh, they might come and take you away to that FEMA camp one of these days. Well, even if that's so, then how much more will you regret at that point when you start to see the people being rounded up for utilizing their free speech? How much more will you regret not having used your free speech to try to speak out against this encroaching tyranny and potentially help to sway or stop or influence other people, at least, into waking up to this? I mean, that, to my mind, is what we all need to be doing. That's why I'm here doing what I'm doing. That's exactly why I started the website. And it was something that really struck me in the early days of the website when I started doing this and telling my friends about it, and they listened and go, and almost invariably my friends would say something like, aren't you afraid you'll be put on some kind of list for talking about this stuff? And my response has been and continues to be and always will be, that is exactly the point. I will not abide by living in a society where we are expected to simply shut up, or else we might have our name on a list somewhere. That is exactly why we need to be speaking up on these issues. So I think that the surveillance society, the surveillance grid, should not be what scares us, especially because we are not the ones doing the illegal things. We are not the ones that are violating every law that's been set up. We are not the ones that are oppressing the population. It is them. They are the ones with something to hide and something to fear, as the old saying goes, or to invert the old saying. So the government should be the ones opening up and being transparent, and the fact that they're not shows that they are the ones with something to hide and something to fear. The population are just people who are, have been kowtowed into thinking that they can't speak up on these issues, and I think that's very much to our detriment. As to the vector of the next attack on our online free speech or anonymity, I mean, there are so many different ways that this could play out, and unfortunately, we're living in the era of virtual false flag terrorism, where literally any sort of event can occur, and they can just say, oh, it sources back to enemy of the week, it sources back to Iran, it sources back to the Syrian Electronic Army, it sources back to North Korea. I mean, they can say whatever they want, and there's absolutely no way for us to have any idea of, or any way of knowing if there's any basis of reality for those claims. So it is kind of the perfect false flag generating system that they have now, and I think that's why we have to take any pronouncement by any so-called authority on any virtual attack, not only with a grain of salt, but basically just throw it out and disregard it as being completely useless information. And unfortunately, we do know that there is an iPatriot Act waiting in the wings. Lawrence Lessig talked about this a few years ago. He's a professor at Harvard talking about copyright issues and the like. He said he was talking to Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, who said there is a Cyber Patriot Act waiting in the wings, waiting for some spectacular event so they can roll it out and introduce the next clampdown on the web. So we do know that that is there and it's waiting, and I think we need to see something like what we saw in resistance to the Syrian debacle. We need to see that kind of resistance immediately in the wake of whatever big false flag virtual terror event they try to roll out in order to convince us that we need them to clamp down on the net for our safety. And to my mind, that is a major vector of attack, but perhaps the scariest is the idea that we will actually be made to purchase, literally purchase, the technology that is being used to track, surveil, and curtail our activities. And obviously I'm thinking about the new iPhone with their fingerprint sensors, the perfect NSA tool, as a recent online parody that everyone should go watch on YouTube points out. It's basically iPhone 5 NSA edition, and now they have your fingerprints and your GPS and what you're typing and what you're thinking at all times, and people are literally lining up around the block for the honor, the privilege of being able to purchase this directly from the company that we know is in bed with the American intelligence complex. And we know that Steve Jobs, for example, had special clearance from the Pentagon for classified material. That was revealed just last year in some documents that were released. Why on earth was Steve Jobs literally being approved for classified material by the Pentagon? I mean, it does not take a genius to put two and two together and realize that Apple and Microsoft and IBM and all of these major companies are not only in bed with the intelligence complex, but they, to a large extent, form the backbone of the new information industrial complex paradigm that we're living in. So I think people have to stop buying their enslavement hardware from these giant companies and start moving towards open source software, open source hardware as well. And the idea of open source manufacturing and 3D printing and the possibilities that opens up for us to get completely off of their enslavement grid is truly exciting.
Well, along those lines, what do you feel about Anonymous and how they're going to play into this or you know, move it along? Do you think that is there anything really legitimate that can happen with them or because of them? What do you think about those people?
Well, it always kind of amazes me when people take the idea of Anonymous at face value. What is Anonymous? Anonymous is anyone who says they are Anonymous. And obviously, I mean, it is transparently 100% obviously true that I'm sure there are well-meaning, true, real activists who do take on that mantle of Anonymous and work in that image, just as there are members of the intelligence community that take on the mantle of Anonymous and work in that image. And no one can stop that from happening, specifically because this is a group that's about anonymity, and is anyone who claims to be Anonymous is Anonymous. So does anyone really think that the billions of dollars in on-the-books funding and the hundreds or billions or trillions of dollars in off-the-books fundings that these intelligence agencies have aren't being used to put on this mantle of Anonymous? Does anyone think that there's some kind of wall the NSA or CIA or any of these agencies are going to go, oh, well, we can't pretend to be Anonymous. That would be a beyond our ethical boundaries. Of course not. So Anonymous just is whatever anyone says it is, and it would be absolutely naive to think that it is not probably predominantly composed of people in the intelligence community, acting in whatever ways suits their interests. And of course, what has been the effect of all of these various Anonymous actions that we've seen so far? They take down websites here and there, and this is supposed to be some sort of revolutionary thing. I don't see how, and all I see is the creation of the narrative that eventually will feed into that iPatriot Act and the clampdown of the web. Oh, look, it's Anonymous. They're scary. They're coming to get you. We better get them. And in order to do that, what do we have to eliminate? Anonymity. I mean, it's built into the very idea itself. Anonymous is the problem, therefore we have to get rid of anonymity. I mean, it's such a basic psyop, and I just can't believe that anyone takes it seriously.
Thank you for that. That's definitely definitely the way a lot of us think, that, you know, if we think we've got it all figured out, then we're wrong to begin with. But I got some offbeat questions. I'm just going to throw them at you, if you don't mind. Have you ever met Benjamin Fulford? And what do you think of what he has to say, you know, as being a member of some kind of secret organization?
No, I have not met him. I don't plan to. I would probably go out of my way to avoid him if I met him. I have absolutely zero interest in Fulford and his disinformation, and I've got a thing that I've put together in the past for people who wrote in about Fulford that I'd send them of some of his predictions, and very specific predictions in 2006, predicting the end of the American economy in October of this year, in 2007, talking about his secret ninja army is going to overthrow Rockefeller in March. And blah, blah, blah. And it goes on and on and on about these specific predictions over and over that always invariably turn out to be 100% incorrect, and yet people continue to believe him. It staggers me. It blows my mind that people just continue to go along with it. But I guess it makes, you know, exciting listening that there's this secret ninja army that he's in touch with that's going to somehow overthrow the New World Order overnight or something along those lines. But I have no time or interest in that, really.
Thank you. All right, I got some people that want to know what that link to the timeline site leading up to 9/11. Do you have a link that you could post for, or at least give us the name of the link?
I'm not sure which site specifically that's in reference to. I'm guessing that's historycommons.org, which has the terror timeline, which is an excellent resource that I hope everyone is familiar with, and if not, I hope they'll start using. I believe that's historycommons.org. I can't check while I'm talking here, but if somebody could check that. That is an absolutely excellent resource, and it has entries on so many different things that are backed up with links directly to the news sources where that information comes from. And that's what I've used time and time again in a lot of my work, including the 9/11 conspiracy theory video, which has just passed 2 million views on my YouTube channel. So absolutely a vital resource. I hope everyone will check it out.
Thank you. I got another one here that's a little off the wall. Have you ever heard of William Henry? And if you have, what do you think of his work?
I don't believe I have. That name doesn't ring a bell except in reference to Patrick Henry, but I don't know who William Henry is.
Well, probably just as well. Let me see if I got... we're running out of time and running out of questions. We have... In your research, have you come to the conclusion that World War III is inevitable? And all that is going on now with news reports of chemical weapons here, there, and everywhere is just a distraction while the evildoers are getting ready to go underground, perhaps in the Ozarks.
If I thought World War III was inevitable, I wouldn't be here talking to you guys on a Wednesday morning. I'd be out enjoying the bright, sunshiny day here in Japan and doing something, I guess, fun with my time as I wait for the apocalypse. Obviously, I think we are not necessarily inevitably heading towards apocalypse. I think World War III is very much a possibility, and I do see the way that that is shaping up, along manipulated lines, of course. In throughout the course of the 21st century, we can see that the new boundaries and war lines are being drawn even as we speak, and we can see, for example, China and Russia and Iran and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization forming into a sort of counterblock to NATO, and we can see the broad outline of a World War III scenario taking shape, and it is obviously worrying to watch, but I don't believe it's inevitable, and I think that we all have a part to play in making sure that that does not become a reality. And the best thing that we can do to make sure that that does not become a reality is to undermine the very premises of the argument itself. Once we start to buy into this ridiculous patriotism and saluting of flags that they try to get us involved with in order to invest our emotional and our identities themselves in these meaningless objects, they can then use those meaningless objects that they have long since bought and paid for and commandeered to make us feel that we really are at war with China and Russia. And when the bombs start flying and everyone rallies around the flag as they always do, then it'll be us versus them. Whereas in reality, it is a system that is being puppeteered from the top by a very few who are interconnected, who have been working together for generations to bring this about. And one only has to look at the countless times on the record that Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller and George Soros and the other master manipulators have talked about the China as the model for the New World Order, literally using that phrase. China is the engine of the New World Order. It's the heart of the New World Order. It's the model for the New World Order. And yet we're so expected to believe that this is the big enemy that World War III is going to be fought against. Of course, it is just a game, exactly as the old Soviet Union was itself just a construct that was propped up by outside intervention, as was exhaustively documented by Anthony Sutton in his work, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And I think we have to start playing a little bit smarter at this game and undermining the overarching ideology itself. It is not a world that is divided into various countries that war with one another. It is a world that is divided into the people at the very, very top of the pyramid inside the all-seeing eye and the rest of us down at the bottom of the pyramid that are supporting it. And just like in Ants or any of these other modern day parables, if we realize that it is literally thousands and thousands and thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of us for each one of them that there is, this system can and would come crashing down overnight. It is a question of consciousness. We really do have to change our perspective of the situation and stop feeding into this propaganda that they love to put out, that the New World Order is unstoppable. We control everything. It's inevitable. Oh, you better run for the hills because you're all going to die. And once we start to internalize that and take that on, we have already lost the game. So it truly is a question of changing our consciousness, changing our perspective, and realizing that the entire system that exists only exists because of our cooperation, whether explicit or implicit. And once we remove that cooperation from the system and we start creating our own independent systems through alternative currencies, complementary currencies, currencies, local trading areas, farmers markets, local economies. Once we start bringing it back down to that level where we actually can and do and in the past have created incredibly wonderful structures in order to feed and sustain and trade with each other, rather than going through these big agro-industrial, pharmaceutical, military-industrial complex behemoths that have been created, we will start to, I think, transition away from that World War III scenario. And I'm under no delusions that this progress is inevitable, and I'm under no delusions that that transition will be easy. I think it is a generational project that starts, I think, at home, literally at home, with the way that we raise our children and the types of things that we do in our own households to choose the way that we interact with the world. So I'm under no delusions that it's an easy path, but I think it's the only alternative, and that's why I'm here doing what I do. So I hope people will start to check out some of this. And for people who are interested in that, I hope they'll go to CorbettReport.com and just type solutions into the search box at the top right corner and look at some of my work on some of these issues in the past to see how people can start affecting, I think, the real change in perspective that we need.
Well, thank you. Thank you, James. Thank you for returning and providing us with your insights, you know, into the global scene. There's many of us that follow your work and appreciate your willingness to inform the world, you know, with your documentation, interviews of other researchers. Would you like to close with anything specific? You just gave your website. I know you have others, but thank you so much for being who you are. And best wishes to you and your family.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. Yes, I am associated with a lot of different websites, and my work can be found all over the web. But the one-stop shop is CorbettReport.com, so I just hope people will go there and check it out. I have thousands and thousands of hours of audio and video media that's available completely for free download. I hope people use it as the resource that it is, and it's just the starting point for your own research. But I hope it is useful and provides some information on some of the issues we've been talking about. And also, for people who are interested in Fukushima specifically, I hope they'll go to FukushimaUpdate.com, which is my Fukushima website. It's being updated on a, if not daily, at least very regular basis by my associate editor, Brock West, who runs a site called APPerspective.net. So I hope people will check that out. And basically, let's work together, because we can't do it unless we stick together on this.
Thank you, James. Thank you, everyone, for attending our guest chat. Refreshments will now be served here in the lobby. And James, you want to go backstage for a moment?
Absolutely. Thank you to everyone who came for this. I really enjoyed the chat.